This is the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast, featuring all your favorite bands from the 70s and 80s. The old stuff, the new stuff, the news, interviews, everything you need for your hard rock and metal fix. Right here, right now.
Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to our first show of the new decade. Much more of the same this year, finding out what all our favourite rock and metal bands from the 70s and 80s are up to in 2011. First up are Mr. Big, who have a new studio album this month, the first in nearly 10 years, and I thought it'd be fun to show them some pictures of the band from back in 1988.
Remember this
guy? Oh my god, that's hilarious.
Oh fuck, man, correct. Look at that. Let me see that. Let me see those chicks.
Hilarious.
Good lord.
It's a poster.
Oh my god.
You don't get those anymore, do you?
That is hilarious.
Look at that jacket, man.
Tony Clarkin, guitarist and songwriter for Magnum, who celebrate their 40th year with a new album this month, remembers when dealings with your record company execs didn't always run smoothly.
We actually made an album. I can remember going to the record company and they were spazzing off about it. And I just said, oh, Sticky, I don't want to be with you like anymore. And just walked out, and that was it. And like, we had to pay him like quite a lot of money, I don't know, 200,000 quid or something, because I'd lost my rank.
An original member of the Alice Cooper band, Dennis Dunaway, spins some tall tales of life with the Coop back in the day. Truth or fiction, you decide.
Zappa and Alice had a gross-out contest on stage, and it was escalating. Zappa decided that he was going to defecate on stage, and the crowd thought, oh, well, Alice can't top that. And then Alice walked over and scooped some up and put it in his mouth.
Those were the days, eh? As always, we'll give you the news roundup with the rest of the major new releases and tour information too. First, it's 25 years this month since the release of Metal's answer to Band-Aid, Hearin' Aid. The song was recorded over 2 days by 40 artists and contains the most obscenely long section of guitar solos ever committed to vinyl.
Who cries for the children?
This is the full-length version of Stars.
Oh.
Great stuff. The song was written by Ronnie James Dio and band members at the time Jimmy Bain and Vivian Campbell, and amongst the artists on there were the unmistakable Rob Halford, Dave Menichetti, Don Dokken, Kevin DeBrow and Yngwie Malmsteen, to name just a few. There is a Facebook campaign to re-record the song for Dio's Stand Up and Shout cancer charity, so if you think that's a good idea, follow the link in our show notes. Now, Mr. Big, you'll probably remember for one of two reasons. Either that they included legendary bass wizard Billy Sheehan, formerly of David Lee Roth's solo band after he split with Van Halen, or more likely for their single To Be With You, which was number one in 15 countries in 1991 and helped the band tour constantly through a decade that saw off many of their contemporaries. They reunited in 2009 to play some anniversary shows and have a new album out this month through Frontiers called What If. I met up with Billy Sheehan and vocalist Eric Martin to find out what it's all about, starting with when they decided to go back in the studio with veteran producer Kevin Shirley.
When we're on tour, live performances of supreme importance to all of us, so we were just concentrating on that. So when we got done with everything, we toured Europe, we did played in India, played in Southeast Asia, did Japan, did a lot of shows, it went swimmingly well, it was just really great. So after all that, we just said, hey, let's do a record. And we did. And that brings us here with you today, Oliver.
How did Kevin get involved in?
He was interested in producing the band, and I just learned that from Eric. I see, I'll find all these things when we do interviews that I didn't know before. I had no idea he was working with Journey at that time. But he was interested in working with us, and he had mixed Zeppelin, worked with Rush, worked with the Black Crowes, worked with Iron Maiden. Everybody in the band has a connection with all those bands at some point or another. And so I thought that was pretty cool. And then he threw us in the room and just kind of made us play. And very, very little overdubbing. I overdubbed about 45 seconds of bass total on the whole record. Everything that you hear was done from takes and that we did. We did a lot of takes rather than being careful and finally stitching together an intricate little thing. We just went in there and blasted.
It's like trademark, Mr. Big. I mean, it's very prevalent on the guitars, really catchy choruses. I mean, were you shooting for anything specific, or was it just...
We just threw at it. We never...
We didn't really know what was going to happen. I mean...
Never do.
Kevin, you know, he didn't give us a lot of direction, but he just said, like, hey, let's not think about it too much. Go in a room, do whatever you guys do. I remember, like, in our headphones, he would talk to us, like, in the middle of, like, takes and stuff. And, like, he would say to Pat Torpey, Keith Moon! Give me Keith Moon! Give me John Bonham, come on, Eric. Or like, yeah, I remember this one time, like I'm singing this thing and he goes, oh, hey, you're not doing this again, kid. But you know, you're not. There's no overdubs for you.
No second
chance. So you want to do this? I'm like hearing this and the band's hearing it at the same time. That was kind of it. I mean, he was kind of a cheerleader, but mainly it was us in a room, hardly any pre-production, just play live. I used to get so frustrated, you know, I'd sing like a guide vocal in the past, you know, and like one of them would go, I don't need you anymore. Go sit in the TV room or something, you know, like, you know, I would like,
nobody got left out.
Yeah, I'd be sitting there reading like, you know, fucking War and Peace or something, you know, waiting for my turn. And this time when I did a couple of guide vocals, I could see Pat going, okay, I got it. I know where you are. I know where you're supposed to be. I'm not going to step on you. And then Kevin was like, no, I want you in there. Stay in there. I'm like, oh, okay, a little scary. No, you know, no second chance to do overdubs. We didn't think about it too much. We just kind of jammed it out. Even when we were writing songs, there was no management or record company going, hey, we need that next To Be With You, kid. You know, nobody like that, which was fucking awesome.
Nobody had anything to do with us until we were done with the record. They didn't hear a thing. They didn't get involved at all.
So when did the songs get written for this album then?
God, only a couple weeks before we actually
about a
did
month
it.
And a half to 2 months prior to actually recording, we started to get together. But we weren't, it wasn't a steady thing. We, Pat, myself, and Paul would get together for 3 or 4 days, lay some ideas down, then send them up to Eric, and then a week would go by, and we'd go in and do a few more. And really a lot of emphasis on something that would catch our ear and sound new and fresh and alive. That was important.
So was there nothing in there that was that you'd had for a while? You're thinking, oh, I can use that now.
Well, one of the songs, actually.
I know what you mean.
American Beauty.
Yeah, American Beauty actually was an older piece.
American Beauty was actually a piece that I think we had written called Trapped in the City long, long time ago.
One of our very first writing sessions.
We kept some words and we rewrote some things. And even like the like for me, in the inflections, the phrasing and the singing that I did back in like 1988, I think, was the same as what I did on this one, which was fun. Total retro. There's a ballad on there called All the Way Up, which is a, you know, sad kind of ballad. And then you got a, like a Stranger in My Life is another ballad, but it's like darker. But then the rest of it is all straight ahead rock, you know. Before when we used to make albums, it would be like, you'd have the fast song, and then you have like the kind of like odd time song, and then you'd have the ballad, and then you'd have this kind of funk song or something. That's just the way it was. I mean, we just kind of, again, we didn't think, you know, too much about that, but that's how we wrote. But on this record, yeah, it's pretty much like every song is rocking.
Yeah, we wanted
spit all over it.
In the back of my mind, I was hoping for a heavier, you know, an up-tempo record, though that's not what I was pushing for. And in the end, that's what we got. And I'm pleased that we did, because I think that I love To Be With You. I love Just Stick My Heart. I love Promise of the Moon. I love all the Mr. Big Ballad stuff. But I also love it when we hit it hard. And we did a lot of that on this record.
Obviously, the band started late 80s and went through the 90s, when a lot of the bands from the 80s died a death. Mm. What are your memories of that period?
You know, the musical climate kind of changed in 96, or in the 90s, right? The grunge kind of came in, which is could be a good thing or a bad thing. We had places to play. I mean, we had campaigned in Japan and Southeast Asia and Europe, and we had places to play where our other friends went back to their first jobs of painting houses and still rocking out, but they didn't bode well. But we definitely had a place to play.
I mean, I guess we
were lucky.
I guess being number one in 15 countries helps.
Yeah,
but
it helps.
Over the course of time, it may sound like a dumb question, but To Be With You was such a huge thing, and then became such a signature thing. Was it a blessing or a curse to have that song?
Blessing.
A blessing, man.
Blessing, absolutely.
You used to say, you know, To Be With You put all these stamps in my passport.
Yeah, it gives us an excuse to, you know, we played India. We played in Thailand. We got a lot of fans in Thailand.
Never been would have been able to play
just,
that.
Just great. And I love the song. You know, there's a couple bands that I know that kind of, they were rock bands, but they had a hit with the ballad, and they hate the ballad. I love our ballad. I love To Be With You. I love Just Take My Heart. I love yep. Promise of the Moon. I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. And it speaks a lot to a lot of people. And one of the reasons to be in a band and be involved in music for me is to reach people, communicate with people. Our best nights back in the old days, when I was in a copy band back in Buffalo, New York, was when the place was packed. I had other friends that were in other bands that played obscure, abstract, crazy things, and the places were empty. And I thought to myself, which would I rather do, play the obscure, abstract things and to an empty house, or play to a full house? I always wanted to play to a full house, because there's always more you can do, and I just like having a lot of people there. It's a beautiful, fun thing. But it's funny, when we had a hit with To Be With You, we'd have quite a mixed audience. We'd go there, and there'd be, you know, 16-year-old girls, and there'd be kids with Metallica shirts. So, but the thing I liked about it best was the 16-year-old girls that were there here to be with you were pumping their fists in the air for Daddy Brother, and the guys in the Metallica shirts were singing along with To Be With You. So I thought, you know, I think we're providing a service here, breaking down the barriers.
The landscape has changed a lot in the last 10 years. I mean, have you got any expectations of...
I know we're just going to tour a lot. I hope the record does well, but the music business is completely different now. And I think trying to depend on a new record to do something is chancy. If it does well, I'm going to be so pleased. If it doesn't do well at all, I'm still so pleased that we did this. But for me, the live show is always the most important thing, and putting a record out certainly gives us I got extra blank pages on my passport now, ready to fill up with some traveling. Back in the day, we did a pretty extensive playing in the UK, though we hadn't gotten to Ireland yet. I would like to be able to play there, but we did the Barrowlands in Glasgow, and we played Edinburgh, we played Nottingham Rock City, we played all over the place, and it was just an incredible experience. So we hope we can come back and do a lot more of that here, because you know, for us as Americans, you know, I got to admit that a lot of the reason why we play is because of British bands. you know. And one of the reasons why Mr. Big is Mr. Big is because Free had a song called Mr. Big, and we love Free, and we love Humble Pie and all the bands and Bad Company. And
so coming back to the motherland.
So for us, yeah, it's really true. It's
bringing it home.
For us, it's a real big thing. And a couple of other journalists that have heard the record have commented that they feel that the record is a lot like that era in British music, the Free, Spooky Tooth, Humble Pie, where it was just, you know, bluesy vocalist on top of a wailing rock band. That's what the original idea was.
Yeah, that's how we dreamed it in the beginning. How, like, wouldn't it be great to have a band like that?
Was American Beauty from the album What If, out this month through Frontiers. Links on where to buy it from in the show notes as usual.
Classic rock and metal news.
Apparently Motorhead guitarist Phil Campbell and drummer Mickey D are a bit peeved that they don't feature much in the new movie about Lemmy. He said that they spent 3 years following me around and Mickey around, all of us, you know, three years, and the biggest shot they got of me is laying down to sleep in the bus with Family Guy on the TV. The movie's about Lem, but it's really insulting to us. What a bunch of c- Kiss's Paul Stanley was at the LA Auto Show to help unveil the new range of Lotus sports cars, and he said, it's amazing because when you have something as legendary and iconic as Lotus, you have to go through a period where perhaps you have to reinvent yourself or rediscover yourself. Yes, Paul, we get the message. Former Guns N' Roses and current Velvet Revolver drummer Matt Sorum has been working with former Runaways lead singer Cherie Curry on her comeback album, which is due sometime in the spring. Now, talk about a great photo opportunity. Our beloved Biff Byford from Saxon, guest on our very first show, of course, has been hobnobbing with Lady Gaga. He went to the show because his daughter couldn't make it, and the shock popster insisted on meeting him. He said, we had a fantastic 50 minutes with Miss Gaga, who's a massive heavy rock fan and Saxon fan, talking everything rock. She's a great lady, and it was a great privilege to meet her. You can check out the rather unique photo of them both in our show notes at classicrockpodcast.com. Now, Mike Portnoy, who you may remember recently left Dream Theater after 20-odd years, has now also parted company with Avenged Sevenfold, who he's been filling in for this year. Apparently, he also tried to go back to Dream Theater, but was rebuffed. He said, fairly recently, I reached out to the guys and tried to make amends and offered to reconcile for the sake of having peace back in our lives, but sadly, they declined my offer. Whitesnake, good old Whitesnake, have a new album coming out in March and have announced tour dates for June, including 6 in the UK. Details of those also in our show notes. Now, a word of warning to the hard partiers out there. Duff McKagan, original bassist, of course, with Guns N' Roses, recently had surgery on his sinuses after he developed a perforation in his septum, which is the bit between your nostrils, due to years of cocaine abuse. Duff once said, I was drinking a gallon of vodka a day, doing cocaine, any pill I could get my hands on, heroin, and on May 10th, 1994, my pancreas exploded. The pain was like in the war movies where they say, kill me, put me out of my misery. Now, of course, Duff is fit as a fiddle and off the hard stuff, as far as we know. Ozzy wouldn't be a news bulletin without Ozzy. Rear-ended a driver in LA, apparently, during December. His Ferrari hit the Mercedes of a lawyer, although no one was hurt and there was very little damage. Ozzy had only recently passed his test after 19 attempts, and the Ferrari had 20 miles on the clock. Ozzy said it took so long to pass his test because he was always drunk or something. He admitted he was so nervous during one of the tests that he'd asked the doctor to prescribe him some tranquilizers. So he said, so when I had to turn the car, I was simply asleep. He said, when I woke up, the examiner had simply disappeared but left a message on a paper on the dashboard. Unfortunately, Mr. Osborne has not passed the exam and would suggest that he never again try to drive his car. And Ozzy also said that instructors and testers have told him, I'm not even f***ing getting in the car with you. The summer festival lineups are starting to take shape, and the big news so far is that the Big Four of Thrash, which is of course Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer and Anthrax, will headline Sonisphere's first day in the UK on the 7th of July. They did it in Europe last year, if you recall, from which the Big Four DVD was filmed and recently released, and they join Biffy Clyro and Slipknot, who will headline the other 2 days. Michael Schenker, guitarist Michael Schenker, former Scorpions drummer Herman Rarebell, and UFO's bassist on hiatus Pete Way have formed a new band called Strangers in the Night with singer Michael Voss. They've been seen causing havoc on the seafront in Brighton, where they're recording new material. Herman, of course, was a guest on our second show. The top-grossing tours of 2010 made interesting reading, with Bon Jovi topping the pile with $146.5 million done. They were some way ahead of U2, and AC/DC, who were third with $122 million. The Eagles were seventh with a very respectable $62 million grossed, narrowly ahead of Metallica. And also in the list were the Trans-Siberian Orchestra on $47 million. And if you want to know more about them, stay tuned because they're playing their first ever show here in the UK in March, so we'll be doing a feature on them around that time. And King Diamond, who is 54, had a triple heart bypass operation recently and is on the mend with no thoughts about quitting the music scene. His 26-year-old wife, Livia Zeta, has been posting updates on his condition. I'm sure he'll be up and about as soon as possible. Magnum, the prog rock band hailing from Birmingham, where else, are celebrating their 40th year bar the mandatory mid-90s hiatus with their 15th studio album, The Visitation, and a European tour. The band has always had a solid following and produced many gems along the way, as well as being firm favourites on the live circuit. The ever-presence through the years have been vocalist Bob Catley and guitarist and soul songwriter Tony Clarkin. I spoke with Tony recently, starting with his recollections of their breakthrough record in 1985 on A Storyteller's Night.
I think it actually cost about 15,000 quid to record,
right,
which is like really cheap. And I think we paid about half of it. And we were that broke, we asked them if they could hang on for the rest of the money,
right,
which they very kindly did. It was quite an enjoyable album to record, Kit Walden producing. And I can also remember Jimmy, the drummer that we had at the time. He'd got the worst sounding drums you'd ever heard. It must have been the worst drum kit ever. I think it had been in a fire or something like that. It had no tonal quality whatsoever left. But how Kit actually got a sound out of it, I'll never know. But I remember seeing him fiddle about and I just couldn't believe it.
I mean, you got the album in the can and then there was certainly a lot more awareness of the band and it just seemed to kind of turn a corner then, didn't it?
I'll tell you why it was a turning point. It was because a DJ heard it in Germany, I think, then spoke to someone at Polydor, a guy called Michael Goller at Polydor, and said, hey, why don't you sign this band, and gave him the album. And he played the album and he contacted us. I mean, at the time we'd got a record deal with a very small Wolverhampton record company, which obviously that was the only company that would even touch us, you know. No one in Great Britain had touched us. I mean, to this day they wouldn't. But anyway, like we get like a record deal. And how it actually got into the charts, I think we went on tour. Oh no, we were in a record shop, do a signing, and the manager found up and said, oh, the album's gone in at, I think, 22 or something like that. Which was like such a, I mean, everyone was really excited about it. And Chase the Dragon went in higher than that. But we'd been through the mill, and it was sort of a bit like going, okay, we're back, you know, we're in with a chance. And it went on to sell a lot of records, you know, and all over the world, really.
And I certainly remember that late 80s, seeing you guys just all over the place, which was great, you know, and Donington and stuff like that. And it was just a real purple patch, and I remember it with a great deal of fondness, I must admit.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I'd say sort of coming up to the late 80s, maybe 86, maybe, something like that. I mean, I got sort of a bit disenchanted with what was happening, in the sense that the guy that had heard On a Storyteller's Night and signed us for Polydor then had left the record company and we got inherited onto other people. And, I mean, I think they looked at the band and thought, what on earth is this? What are we supposed to do with this band, you know? And they started to tug and pull us in ways that we weren't supposed to be going at all. I mean, I can remember having a phone call from one of the record people, and he went like, look, you've got to sell 2 million albums on this next album, and blah, 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 you know, and Def Leppard and Whitesnake and all this sort of business. And I went, what on earth do you think they've got on their hands here? You know, this is crazy. Yeah. I mean, I can't believe for 1 minute I thought we were like a commercial band at the time. But, I mean, this happened after Wings of Heaven, which, for us, that album did really pretty good. I think it was number 2 album.
Yeah.
Sold a lot of copies, but they needed, you know, need to sell more and more. And you've got to write a hit single. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. You've got to go and write with other people. I'm going, what the hell's happening here?
Well, I mean, shooting forward, we've got The Visitation. Is it in a way nicer now to go, right, okay, we don't really have to answer to anybody about, I mean, obviously it's on SPV, Steamhammer, but is there less pressure now? Can you just get out and do it?
There is less commercial pressure on us, that's for sure. And I have a good relationship with Ollie Hahn from SPV. And we're allowed total artistic freedom.
Yeah.
And he went, yes, of course, Tony. He said, you know about Magnum. And he said, and I handled the other things. And it's been like that since we've been with SPV, which is great.
I mean, I obviously been listening to it for the last week or 10 days, and it's unusual for me, but I found it very accessible first time I heard it. If that happens, it's a sign that I'm going to listen to that particular record for a long time. And some records I've been listening to for 30-odd years. So to me, it's as, what I'm trying to say is, it's as good as anything I've heard in a long time.
Oh, okay, thanks. You've got to remember, because I write all the songs, and I write the songs how I like the sort of music I like. That's what this album is. I mean, every time I write a song, it's to please me, obviously. I mean, I can't write songs to please someone else. What it is, I write songs to please me and hope other people like them, pretty much. That's the sort of formula, if you like, if you could call it that. But that's all I can do, really. So anybody that liked this album or any of the stuff we've really ever done, they must pretty well like the stuff I like. That's all I can say, you know.
A lot of our people may not actually know that you're the only songwriter for the band. That is pretty unusual. I mean, most bands will have one or more people who kind of think, well, I can do that, I'll have a bit of a go of it. But it never seems to have been that way with Magnum. It's always been you, hasn't it?
The truth is, I don't think anybody else can write songs. I mean, nobody's ever said they want to. I know Bob insists that he couldn't possibly write a song, I know that.
Has your method of writing changed over the years? Have you been influenced by the changing styles? Because I say, you're almost 4 decades, really. I mean, has it changed you at all?
I guess before we did an album, we'd go into a rehearsal studio. If there were 8 songs, we'd book 8 days in the studio. And we'd rehearse for 8 days, you know, 1 song a day. And then we'd be going into the studio to record it.
Right.
So you didn't really have time to play around with anything, really. It was all 1, 2, 3, go, and it sort of ended up as it was.
Yeah.
These days, of course, this, because of the equipment side of things, like editing the song up, for instance. I mean, when I write a song and it's 10 minutes long and I go, that's boring the daylights out of me, or it needs to be half that long, you know, I can just cut it up and go, oh yeah, that's better. But in the old days, just editing the thing up, that was like tough. So you needed a good engineer in those days to do it, you know.
Goodnight in LA, which was out in 1990, remember, had a song called Rocking Chair, which I remember at the time you said was a comment on the band's senior status, unquote. So that was in 1990. If you had a follow-up, what would it be called now?
Oh, my God. I don't think I said that, did I?
Yes, you did. I've got it in print.
Really? Well, I was drunk at the time, I don't know. I mean, I think it may have been a comment on... I'll tell you the honest truth then. Maybe that was my press answer.
Listen, also, we give special thanks on this show for any band that I can speak to that was in the first 20 issues of our beloved Kerrang in the UK. And you were in number 15, so God bless you for that. But holding a cigarette, I might add, in the photograph...
But about like 5 fags in your mouth. Was it that?
As far as I can see, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember that, also I've got my 335, Gibson 335. Right. I think it's that photograph. One of my roadies dropped a Marshall amp straight through it. I mean, it would be worth a lot of money now, because now it's just bits. So.
Oh, God. That's great.
I feel sorry for that guitar. That's a shame.
Great stuff. Magnum are playing all over the place in April. The album, The Visitation, is out now through SPV, as you heard. Links for both in our show notes. In the meantime, you can feast your ears on a Clarkin special, the single from the album, which is the wonderful Wild Angels.
Nobody's leaving this world tonight. The way I'm feeling will be alright. Forsaken, nobody cares. I wonder what you're thinking. I don't know where you are. Can't stop my heart from singing before it gets too far.
by gently, and shadows creep. But come tomorrow, there's no relief, and I'm still looking in disbelief. I wonder what you're thinking.
Okay, so name this rock star. He wrote School's Out, Elected, I'm 18, and Under My Wheels, to name a few. He was just shy of the final shortlist for a Grammy this year, and he's about to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If you're thinking Alice Cooper, you're close, but wrong. Dennis Dunaway was part of the original Alice Cooper band until 1974, helping shape the sound of not just that band, therefore, but millions of others, and credited for creating much of their infamously shocking stage show. He has several current projects, including Blue Coop, which includes Joe and Albert Bouchard of Blue Oyster Cult, and the fabulous Fifth Avenue Vampires. Both bands released albums in 2010. Most recently, though, he went back in the studio with Alice and fellow former bandmates Michael Bruce and Neil Smith to work on the sequel to Welcome to My Nightmare, along with legendary producer Bob Ezrin.
We did three songs, a song that Michael originally wrote, and one that Neil, and one that I originally wrote, and then we collaborated with Bob Ezrin and Alice on each of those songs.
It was the kind of news, really, that a lot of fans' dreams were made of. I mean, were you surprised that Alice and Bob decided to do it, and did you need any convincing?
Well, none of us would ever have needed any convincing. I mean, we've always all been there. It came as a little bit of a surprise, except that it was in the wind that we were going to be nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, but because Alice was working on another album, and then Bob Ezrin came on board, and then the direction changed. It's Welcome to My Nightmare, as you probably know. Therefore, a lot of the people who have worked with Alice throughout his solo career are guesting on this album. And then Alice was in love with this song that I had written. He played it on his radio show quite a few times, actually. And he decided that he wanted to do a song like that. So I think that's kind of what kicked it off a little bit. The main ingredient is that Bob Ezrin was on board for it. So he, I suspect, was a big catalyst in it.
Do you think there's any chance we'll see more shows with the original band, maybe even outside the U.S.?
It all really depends on fan response. You know, if the fans respond well, then there may be some other things in the wind.
Now, you've actually known Alice since you were kids, haven't you?
Well, actually, I met Alice in high school. He was 14 and I was 15, I believe. And, you know, we were just skinny nerds that thought we were really hip, but we were on the long-distance track team. And this was in Phoenix, Arizona, so we would run in high heat. And so you had to be kind of crazy to do that to begin with, but we had this keep going no matter what, which I think really helped apply to the band, as we used to get knocked down over and over again in the early days. And we were also in journalism class. So that, I think, had a lot to do with our seeing eye to eye when we wrote lyrics. And we were also in art class. So I think that had a lot to do with our seeing eye to eye on our visual theatrical props and our concepts, because we like the surrealist movement the most. The very first show that Alice and I and Glenn did was at Cortez High School, a Halloween dance, and Alice and I hung clothesline to look like giant spider webs on the stage. Then we made some coffins out of cardboard boxes and painted them to look like wood. And we had a friend of ours who took a lot of early photographs of the Alice Cooper group named Scott Ward, and his father was a carpenter, and he built us an actual guillotine, even though it was, as I recall, only about 6 feet tall. But it actually, the blade came down and everything, and we used that. And we had a guy named Ray Sadowski who dressed up with makeup, and he stayed in the coffin, so we didn't know anything about having a set list in those days. That's how green we were. And so while we would discuss what song we wanted to do next, this guy would come out of the coffin between songs and do some funny shtick, and then he'd go back in the coffin, and then we would do our next song. But with that makeup, the guillotine, the spider webs and everything were the elements of the very first show we ever did, and we just loved it so much. To this day, those elements are still in Alice's show.
In 1970, the band, I think, and you moved to Detroit. Did you learn a lot from the scene at the time, from bands like the Stooges and MC5?
Oh, absolutely. As soon as we arrived there, that high energy was required. The Detroit audiences were extremely loyal to their local bands. It was always full tilt energy on the behalf of the audience, everybody standing with their fists in the air. Stooges and MC5 set the bar for that. And the trade-off was, as soon as we arrived, the MC5 went to shiny fabrics in their outfits, and Iggy wore silver lamé gloves, and so there was a good trade-off there, I think.
What do you think you guys had as a band that meant that you hit it big, whereas bands like the Stooges and MC5 didn't? They got bogged down in all the drugs and stuff. What is it that you guys did differently?
As far as the Stooges, I always thought that they sounded much better live than they did on their albums. And it may be because they either had their amps too loud in the studio or whatever, but they were a live band, and they were extremely exciting and innovative. MC5 were the same. It was just as loud as they could crank their amps, and it sounded great when you were
at a festival or something, but when you get in the studio, I think the difference was the Alice Cooper group was able to turn our amps way down so that we could get a cleaner, more radio compatible sound.
Do you have a favorite Alice Cooper album from that time?
Well, I do love them all. Pretty's for You, I think, was our most innovative, our most unique, and most artistic. But as far as across the board playing, I like Killer. On Killer, we walked in knowing that people would be listening, and we were playing our best across the board, and I think the band was at its peak for it just being a band. It was us and Bob Ezrin, but we didn't have all of these outside influences of these people that move in when success hits and all of a sudden everybody in the world is telling you what you should be doing.
There's always a question after that time as well, is that why the band and Alice went their separate ways? It's been reported that he wanted to go more theatrical and you guys were wanting to concentrate on the music. Was that true?
No, as a matter of fact, I've always resented that statement because if it weren't for me, the band wouldn't have been doing theatrics in the first place. And the Billion Dollar Babies band did a gigantic production. We had an amazing show. So that wasn't true. That was just a big smoke screen to make it look like Alice had to move on his own. And, you know, what are they going to say? Well, we wanted to make all of the money on the new contract.
When you look at that footage of snakes and chickens going into the crowd, maybe it's just kind of that sort of grainy 70s film stock, but it's still kind of shocking to see all those clips from the stage show.
Well, it also had to do with what was going on back then, that it's really hard to keep in perspective how shocking it was. The closest thing was Hendrix lighting his guitar on fire, you know, with Jerry Lee Lewis lit his piano on fire. And then the Who smashing their equipment, that was exciting and theatrical. That influenced us, but generally it was, you know, the Mamas and the Papas and the Birds and, you know, all of these other bands that were rather tame in their stage presentation. And also the other thing I think that is hard to keep in perspective is you can do almost anything now to be shocking. Back then, we had the sensors on our throat. Every time we'd show up to play, the commissioner of everything else in the world and the Humane Society and the, you know, everybody would show up to stop us from playing.
I mean, aside from all of this, there's the Dennis Dunaway project that you've had albums out for. The Blue Coop band, which is yourself and the Bouchard brothers from the Blue Oyster Cult, and you were recently just missed out on the final shortlist for the best rock song for the Grammys this year, but that's eligible for next year, I understand. But my pick of the crop is an album which I picked up 2 or 3 months ago. It was released in May of 2010, and that was the Fifth Avenue Vampires, which is possibly the best cover artwork I've seen in a long time. It's one of my favourite albums of the last few years, and it includes Richie Scarlett, who played with Ace Frehley, and obviously with Mountain, a big fan of his. It's a great, great record.
Wow, that's great to hear. There's a disc jockey in Cleveland that plays it all the time. He also claims it's his favourite album of last year. Yeah, the Fifth Avenue Vampires actually have 2 new songs in the can for our next album. Blue Coop have 4 songs in the can, so everything's moving forward at a blistering pace. I have so many irons in the fire, I can't even tell you about all of them. But the thing that's great about it is the caliber of musicians that I'm lucky enough to work with makes everything like just so, it keeps my creative juices flowing.
A real music legend, Dennis Dunaway. Talk to Dennis and trust me, you'll know you've been given a lesson in what's what. We chatted for nearly an hour and someday we'll put the rest of that interview online for you to hear. It's all great stuff, believe me. Incidentally, the story about Alice eating Frank Zappa's dung that you heard at the top of the show is pure hokum. It was Dennis's favourite untrue rumour about the band from back in the day. Went around for years apparently and drove them all nuts. We talked about the Fifth Avenue Vampires in the interview, and rightly so, because if you like the sound of the early Alice Cooper band, this should probably be your next purchase. The album is called Drawing Blood, and this wonderful track is called, appropriately, Vampires of Fifth Avenue.
Vampires silver bullet and a steady gun. He forever will dwell in evil delight, toasting a drink, taking a bite. Timeless passions, rotted dreams can all be yours, but don't dare scream. On the prowl on the avenue, sneaking round looking for you.
Just out or recently out are the new one from Motorhead, The World Is Yours. Doro Pesh has a 2 DVD and CD set out called 25 Years in Rock. Doro used to be the singer in Warlock back in the day, if you remember. Man O' War, who as you heard are playing some shows this year in the UK, have re-recorded their infamous Battle Hymns album, and that's out this month too. If melodic rock is your bag, then contender for Album of the Year already is by Houston, so check that one out. I mentioned them earlier, and the all-conquering Trans-Siberian Orchestra have a new album this month called Beethoven's Last Night. Frontiers have reissued all the main studio albums by Triumph. That's a 10-CD set called The Diamond Collection. Reckless Love have an expanded version of their debut album, which is out with 5 additional tracks. Eagle Rock have reissued 2 by Twisted Sister, Club Days Volume 1 and You Can't Stop Rock and Roll. There's a 2-disc deluxe version of Rainbow's Down to Earth with tons of extras on it, well worth parting with cash for. And in the month that sees the 25th anniversary of Phil Lynott's death, Jailbreak, Johnny the Fox and Live and Dangerous, the Thin Lizzy albums get the full deluxe reissue treatment. Incidentally, the new Thin Lizzy lineup is on tour in the UK this month. Dates in the show notes as usual, and if the polls align, we may well be chatting to them next month. Finally, 2 often neglected Black Sabbath albums are reissued in deluxe format, Seventh Star and the Eternal Idol. In fact, I think they were released in December. Originally planned as a solo album for Tony Iommi, label pressure turned Seventh Star into part of the Sabbath catalogue, and of course featured Glenn Hughes on vocals. The Eternal Idol originally featured Hughes' tour replacement, Ray Gillen, on vocals, no relation, but his parts were in turn re-recorded prior to release by his replacement, Tony Martin. Gillen sadly passed away in 1993, and this reissue includes both versions of the album, so worth having because he had a great voice. In celebration of these releases, to remind you what great albums they are, and to tip my hat to Glenn Hughes, who helped make a really memorable show the other night in London with Black Country Communion, I'll play you out with the first track off Seven Star, In For The Kill.
With fury, the king is come. The power, the terror will reign. There is no mercy, I'm pleading. In for the kill, no quarter to be shown. In for the
Okay, that's all for us this month. All the albums mentioned and live dates are in the show notes for you, so check them out. Have a good month. See you all again in February.